Hello and welcome to the RVC podcast. My name is Matthias Kleins, and today we will be talking about Bluetom, a viral disease of ruminants which causes immense suffering in affected sheep and heavy losses to the farming community. In the past, Bluetom was restricted mainly to the African continent and the Middle East. After expanding to the southeastern Mediterranean, disease outbreaks were seen in Central Europe last year, and 6 weeks ago, the first sheep were confirmed infected in the United Kingdom. We will therefore take the opportunity to talk to Joao Falluni, a senior farm animal clinician at the Royal Veterinary College, about his experience with Bluetom disease. So Joao, you work at the Royal Veterinary College in the farm animal practice, but originally you come from Israel.
Yes.
So in relation to the recent outbreak of Bluetom disease here in the UK, you have seen that disease in Israel whilst you're working as a vet there. Could you tell us how this disease actually suddenly became prevalent here, how it got from
in Northern Europe, how it's got from
the south to the north?
I think it starts quite a long time ago. The disease was originally diagnosed in South Africa, if I'm not mistaken, in the 18th century, but don't hold me accountable for that. And then started travelling up north, and it was considered sort of a sub-Saharan disease, and later start affecting the Middle East and or the Mediterranean basin. I think when Europe is concerned that in 1998 the disease started climbing into southern Europe, countries like Italy and the Balkan countries, Kosovo
Greece and Turkey,
and became established there. And then all of a sudden, in 2006, it jumps into Northern Europe, and you see, we got cases in the Netherlands, in Luxembourg, in Germany, and in Belgium. Surprisingly, though, the serotype, and there are 24 serotypes of the virus, the serotype that affected Northern Europe was BTV, or Bluetom virus serotype 8, which is an African one. It is not the one that affected Southern Europe and the Balkan countries. These were different strains, so it's not as if there was a slow creeping or slow crawling of the virus north. It's just jumped from Africa, a different serotype altogether, jumped into Northern Europe. And I think the epidemiology thought is now that someone has imported a wild animal, or I think people claim that a lot of Belgians tend to keep their own sort of private wildlife zoos, and someone has imported an impala that was infected with the disease, and that's how it started. That's how that African strain has jumped straight into Northern Europe.
Well, that would be sad, but before we go on to talk even more about why the disease probably is progressing, whether that's because of a zoo or for other reasons, can you tell us from your own experience, what does Bluetom disease look like in the animals? What's the problem these animals show from a clinical point of view?
Right. I have to say that, again, I was exposed to the disease, or first seen the disease, in Israel, and it turned up on a very seasonal basis, every October and November, which is the peak season for the vector. And the strains that we were, or the serotypes that we had back there, has shown clinical disease only in sheep, only in small ruminants. We didn't get any clinical signs in cattle. Animals become very, very sick and very poor. There's a very high spike in temperature, with rectal temperatures getting up to 42 degrees Celsius. The animals become very stiff and very lame due to coronitis. There's an inflammatory process in the coronary band. And if you sort of wash the hoof or the horn, you can see those purple lines of where there's basically micro hemorrhages.
And that is because the virus affects epithelial cells as well as the lining of small blood vessels. So the blood vessels leak. So
yeah, blood vessels leak, and it destroys sort of the lining of blood vessels, and that's why you get those sort of immediate effect, and also necrosis of the tissue that's being supported or provided by those blood vessels. Apart from that, the striking feature is puffy faces and sort of puffy lips and edema or submandibular edema, and sort of the whole face becomes sort of enlarged and really puffy. And later you get erosions in the mouth, and the animals salivate quite a lot. This is usually followed by respiratory signs. So there's, first of all, salivation, and then you get nasal discharge and panting and heavy breathing. And that's usually because of secondary bacterial infection. And most of the animals will...
And that's where the disease then can also become fatal.
That's when the disease becomes fatal, and it becomes fatal in quite a lot of the cases. I think, well, the BBC and the newspapers quote 70% mortality rate, which is the highest ever recorded, I think. But you can definitely talk about 10 to 30% mortality rate, which is still devastating for every farmer.
Most
animals will die within 7 to 10 days from onset of clinical signs. Some of them will die quicker, especially if they're younger. And those who recover take very, very long to recover and to return to productivity, if at all.
But they will be immune at the end, is that right?
It's fairly short-lived. Because, for instance, when we vaccinate animals, we vaccinate them on a yearly basis.
Yeah.
So I don't think the immunogenicity of the virus is very high, but I'm afraid we'll have to ask some virologists about that.
We do that.
But there's definitely, what we can definitely say is, if you develop immunity, you develop immunity to that one single serotype. And the other 23 can come and visit the next day. And then you get... disease again. A few of them cross over, but it's not as if one serotype would defend you against all 24 others.
You've already mentioned that this is a viral disease which uses a vector, so it's actually not contagious. So that means one animal usually doesn't affect another animal, but it goes via a vector. Can you tell us more about these vectors, especially as these are possibly important for why the disease progresses also on a geographic scale?
Yeah. Well, you're definitely right in what you said. This is a viral disease, so animals do not transmit the disease to their neighboring animals. It's a virus, it's a rail virus, rail orbivirus, that's carried by midges, Culicoides midges. The classic vector,
so they're blood-sucking
is
insects,
blood,
right?
Yes, these are blood-sucking insects. The female would feast off an infected animal, off a viremic animal. The midge will be infected straight away and would become infective 4 or 5 days later. And then one bite is enough to infect one animal. Initially, it was Culicoides imicula that was transferring the disease, or was, you know, the classic vector in the African, sub-Saharan and Mediterranean areas. What's interesting in the current situation in Northern Europe is that you've got three different vectors that have adopted that virus and managed to carry it and propagate it very, very successfully. So these are the Culicoides obsoletus, Culicoides policaris, and Culicoides dewolfi, which is, I think, the one that's most associated with the Northern Europe outbreak. And the strains that we have here in Northern Europe and in the UK is serotypes, not just the strain, but the serotype is serotype 8, which, again, we see clinical disease in cattle, which is something not usually seen with the majority of other serotypes. So there's a virus that's possibly changing, or the clinical manifestation of the disease changes, and the vectors change. We've got now, you know, different midges that can propagate the disease, and midges are very, very difficult to stop.
So the theory that, for example, global warming plays a role in this is probably rather unlikely, because we suddenly have a different virus here in Northern Europe using different vectors. So it doesn't look like the disease which has occurred in Southern Europe a couple of years ago is slowly progressing as temperatures go up and these imicula Culicoides spread across the globe.
You're right. It's not that imicula can survive now in northern territories, but I think global warming unfortunately does help a bit, because all these midges can survive a lot better, or their infectivity rises when the temperatures are...
They'll be present for a longer time.
Their population will be higher because they like the warm weather. And so they can survive longer, and they can, you know, they'll be there for longer, and we'll see more clinical disease, unfortunately, because they're very active in mild temperatures.
You've already mentioned that it's a viral disease. What does that actually mean for the treatment of animals?
We're talking about livestock. So expensive antivirals, as you would use in human medicine or sometimes in companion animal medicine, these are not very applicable. And usually, with farm animals, the treatment would be supportive treatment. And we will try to, in the majority of cases, use non-steroidal anti-inflammatories to ease the pain and the swelling and inflammatory process, and also usually give the most severely affected animals antibiotics to cover them against the secondary bacterial infection that happens in the majority of these cases. Now, as I've mentioned, the clinical signs are terrible in small ruminants, but a lot of other animals are susceptible to the disease. So cattle is susceptible, although in the majority of signs they just become viremic for a long time and then can propagate the virus. Camelids and camels, even carnivores, so even dogs, wild dogs were recorded being infected with the virus, and even domestic dogs were inoculated by a vaccine that was contaminated. That was BTV11, if I'm not mistaken. So even dogs can harbor the disease. Again, we don't need to scare anyone. I don't think we'll start seeing the disease in pets, in dogs on a regular basis. And again, a manifestation in cattle in Northern Europe is a bit surprising as well, because we have seen cows with quite serious clinical signs, quite severe clinical signs. But usually the problem lies with small ruminants.
Okay, now that we know that treatment is not a great option, I think we have to start thinking about prophylaxis. So
prevention of the disease, basically.
What are the strategies which are being used? Are there vaccines out there? Are there vaccines for all the strains of Bluetongue virus?
I think we can divide those into two. There's the vaccination route, and there's the husbandry measures that you can try to take and to reduce the prevalence of the disease. And there can be a combination of the two. Let's talk about vaccination. There are vaccines in the market. These are live vaccines. Unfortunately, they're not available for all serotypes. So, for instance, for serotype 8 that's now present in the UK and in Northern Europe, there is no vaccine. And we're hoping it's in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to be a live modified vaccine. But again, I'm not 100% sure. We're hoping these will become available next year, hopefully in spring or summer.
So that would help us to protect us from the next hopefully season, basically, because they mainly occur in autumn time, late summer, autumn, right?
Well, there's two peaks for those midges. There's a peak in May, June, which is a fairly early peak, unfortunately, and there's another peak in sort of September time, so autumn time. So I'm hoping we won't be too late for the first peak, because that's when the temperatures are right and the humidity and you know the areas are wet enough for these little creatures to survive better in. So we're hoping that the vaccine will be there for spring or summer of 2008, and hopefully yes, it will help us to combat the disease. I'm just hoping we won't miss the first wave of attack of the midges.
If we would, then you say husbandry would be an additional measure we could use to protect animals from contracting the disease. What would that entail?
Right. We know that these midges basically breed in either manure-contaminated stagnant water, or some of them, they have been breeding in actually horse manure, or just, you know, soil and feces. The classical vector, the Colicoides imicula, didn't like houses too much, so it didn't go into housing. So in the Middle East, if you housed your animals during dusk and dawn, which is when the midges are very active, then you would get less clinical disease because the animals were not exposed. So bringing the animals indoors helped. Cleaning manure and also insect repellents were used. Unfortunately, what you see now in the midges that are now involved with the disease in Europe actually really like indoors. So they will join the animals indoors, survive better because they're not exposed to the elements, and infect the animals. So, and I'm afraid that the Dutch epidemiology report for 2006 and the German epidemiology report for 2006 have shown that, unfortunately, all those husbandry measures like insect repellent used on the animals and housing them didn't really make a lot of difference. Now, you can say, yeah, we haven't checked it for long enough, and maybe it does have an effect, but having a controlled study is quite difficult to perform, basically. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but then again, if you come to a farmer in Cumbria and say you should bring your 3,000 ewes indoors, he's going to look at you and say, where exactly do you want me to bring them into? Because these are animals that are outdoors. They're outdoors the whole time. So, you know, finding a place for your 15,000 ewes or 3,000 ewes in the Cumbrian fields can be a bit tricky. So we're in a difficult situation here, because even if you do house them, some of the midges will join them there and we'll have, you know, we'll celebrate together. And if you keep them outdoors, insect repellent can't be a bad thing. But again, I have to say that some epidemiological evidence is are there to say that it still hasn't stopped the disease much.
So we're still waiting for that vaccine, which will ultimately help us. Because even culling at the moment, which of course would be controversial from an ethical point of view in the first place and a welfare point of view, doesn't seem to stop the disease. At least it has not been recommended by the authorities so far, right?
No, the EU does not. Once the disease becomes, you know, circulates in the local population, or once it's endemic in the country, and I believe that is now the situation both in the UK and Northern Europe, there is no compulsory culling policy issued by the EU, and every case is judged. So you could say if you cull the infected animals, you reduce the reservoir. But then again, it is quite controversial. And if the virus overwinters successfully, then if you keep culling and it keeps, you know, overwintering, then it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to really help you. Unfortunately, nowadays, we still don't know how the virus overwinters or how it overwintered in Northern Europe. There's a few theories about that, whether it survived in the host, hiding in B lymphocytes, T lymphocytes, dendritic cells, or the likes, or whether there's transovarial transmission of the virus in the midges and it survived with larvae of the midges over winter. So there's still a lot to investigate over there.
Okay, well, thank you very much for all that information and the great insight you've provided to us.
Thank you, Matthias. Thanks.
That's it from the RVC podcast for today. Thank you again for listening, and don't forget to check out our webpage or iTunes again in 2 weeks' time, when we will be looking in more detail at the virus that causes blue tongue disease and how vaccines against such viruses are developed and produced. In the meantime, if you have any suggestions or feedback, please send them to podcast@rvc.ac.uk. Goodbye.